This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the people of Haiti remember a time when they had a real army that fought against slavery and foreign oppression. U.S. prosecutors try to put hundreds of demonstrators in prison for breaking the same window. And Mumia Abu-Jamal writes a book that asks the question, have Black lives ever mattered? But first, Democrats, corporate media, and U.S. spy agencies have combined to make Russia the boogeyman for every crisis and failure of the United States. We spoke with Daniel Kovalik, a professor of human rights at the University of Pittsburgh and author of the book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. We asked Kovalik, what's the motive for scapegoating Russia and who's behind it?
Well, I think there are a few different motives depending on who's pushing it. I think most importantly, the military-industrial complex, as we have known from people like President Eisenhower and George Kennan, who was the father of the Cold War, the military-industrial complex is always needed to have enemies, and as George Kennan said, if we lose one, we actually have to invent one. And I think in this case, we have invented one in Russia to justify our continued military footing, our eternal war footing that is bleeding this country dry, but it allows it to be bled dry without much protest. And you see, there's very little protest, and I think in part because the Democrats and the liberal base, who used to be at least part of the peace movement, are the ones pushing this Russia hysteria more than anyone. I think they're pushing it for the reason I just mentioned, but of course the Democrats are also pushing it because they want to cover their tracks for what appears to be an impossible loss to Donald Trump in the 2016 election.
Yes, clearly the Democrats have their institutional reasons centered on domestic concerns of their own, but the engine seems to be what some folks call the deep state.
Yes, absolutely, and you see this very clearly. We saw this, you know, when Trump was elected because he was making some overtures at the time to Russia, you know, uncharacteristically. The head of the CIA stated publicly that Trump should rethink whether he wants to reset relations with Russia. And in fact, there seemed to be a threat in that. And again, the CIA rarely speaks publicly on issues. They tend to work behind the scenes. So this was one time when the CIA popped its head up to make it clear that rapprochement with Russia was not acceptable. We saw this again when Trump met with Putin at the G20 earlier this year. They had a good meeting. They agreed on working together in Syria, in Ukraine. And a couple weeks later, Congress nearly unanimously votes to increase sanctions against Russia for no apparent reason. We see that any chance that peace is going to break out between the U.S. and Russia appears to panic many in the establishment in Washington.
Yes, in fact, the Congress has passed legislation that would prohibit Trump from doing anything about the sanctions.
That's right, which again is something quite unusual. They made sure that the President of the United States would have no wriggle room to lower the sanctions. And I think what that means is that they are almost ensuring that relations between Russia and the United States will remain sour, possibly for years to come. And it's very dangerous because we appear to be more and more headed towards some sort of armed confrontation with Russia. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has moved the nuclear clock from 5 minutes to midnight to 3 minutes to midnight, based on their conclusion that, in fact, because of this new Cold War, we are at the greatest threat of a nuclear war since 1953. And that should be of concern to everyone.
And in terms of the corporate media's campaign, it's gone beyond just Trump. The corporate media lately has been saying, essentially, that Trump is being chumped by the Chinese, too.
Yes, exactly. And again, I think what we see manifest is the U.S. almost consensus amongst the U.S. political establishment, media establishment, that there can be no competitors to the United States anywhere in the world, even at their own borders. You know, so China is not allowed to operate freely in the South China Sea, right? Russia is not able to operate freely on its borders. Persia or Iran is not able to operate freely in the Persian Gulf. The U.S. has decided, and I guess decided long ago, that it would have dominion over the earth and that there shall be no competitors. And right now, Russia and China represent the most likely competitors to the U.S. And so there is an attempt to knock them down a peg, if not, again, to stir up some sort of confrontation.
And the left in the United States is increasingly not being allowed to operate freely or at all.
Right. So you see, you know, RT now has to register as a foreign agent. There's now attempts against Sputnik. You see, Google has changed their algorithms in a way that are leading searches away from progressive publications like Counterpunch, Alternet, and others. It's of grave concern. And again, what is troubling is that there's huge swaths of the liberal establishment who would generally oppose such censorship. They seem to be cheering it on. They've latched on to this Russiagate controversy with all their might. And now the folks who might have been the victims of McCarthyism are now pushing the new McCarthyism. A great example of this, of course, is Rob Reiner, who started this bizarre committee to investigate Russia group.
Not to mention his friend God, I mean Morgan Freeman.
Exactly. The voice of God himself, right. Who says in that video that you're referring to that we are at war with Russia. The idea that someone could say such a thing and almost wish such a thing is just, it's hard to fathom. And those of us who can see through this need to speak out against it, because there's really not enough people speaking out against this anti-Russia hatred.
The comparisons with the McCarthy era are, of course, obvious, but even during that era, we had corporate media folks like Edward R. Murrow who were resisting. We don't see any of that today.
No, I think the press is in the worst state, certainly that I have ever seen it. There is little to no dissent in the mainstream press, certainly on matters of foreign policy. There is almost unanimity in the mainstream press that our wars are somehow just, that the hatred against Russia is somehow justified. It's very disappointing, and it's very hard to break through to the American public for that reason.
Well, of course, Russia has hampered U.S. plans in the Middle East, specifically in Syria. Since 2015, Russia's intervention has blocked the United States and its proxies in the jihadist hordes.
Yes, and again, people, sensible people, should welcome that. And yet they don't, because again, Russia has been, all of their conduct in Syria has been vilified, even while the U.S. does, you know, very similar things next door in Mosul, for example. And the great journalist Robert Fisk from the Independent of London has pointed out this double standard. I'll also note, and again, I welcome this, that Putin just helped Venezuela renegotiate its foreign debt in such a way that Venezuela won't even have to start repaying Russia for 6 years, you know. Again, this is something we should welcome. We need a counterbalance to the United States, which I believe really is the greatest threat to peace in the world.
The net effect of these U.S. pressures, not just against Russia, but against China, has been to drive those two great powers into each other's arms.
Well, exactly. And, you know, the irony here, of course, is that the U.S. is going to lose out from all this. The U.S. is sanctioning everyone. And so what we see, for example, is that now countries like Venezuela are turning, you know, to China. They are wanting to turn away from the U.S. dollar and to trade oil on Chinese currency. And now I think you're going to see countries do this in droves. They're going to turn away from the U.S. dollar. The dollar will be devalued and U.S. interests will be harmed. But these longer term results don't seem to be foremost in people's mind when they play these games.
Ironically, those consequences will probably be laid at Trump's doorstep.
Yes, absolutely. He will be to blame, even though, you know, at least on this front, on the Russia front, he actually has the most sensible position. It may be the only sensible position he has. And again, and as I note in my book, I mean, it's a tragedy that the one decent policy he has is the one policy that is being singled out for opposition. And it just boggles the mind.
That was Professor Dan Kopelik, author of the book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. Police in Haiti violently crushed protests against plans to reactivate the Haitian army, which was abolished as a force of repression and corruption. However, over the weekend, many Haitians remembered when their country had a real army, one that fought for human liberation. Daoud André is a Brooklyn-based radio host and Haitian community activist.
It's 214 years since the Battle of Thiers. This is the last battle that our ancestors fought, and the decisive battle in which they defeated Napoleon's army in Saint-Domingue. It's about 65,000 troops. We understand that the Napoleon ruler of France at the time had sent to Saint-Domingue to restore slavery because our ancestors, under Toussaint Louverture's leadership, had fought and won, not independence, but freedom, the end of slavery in this French colony. And after Napoleon had restored slavery in Guadeloupe, other French possessions, he sent this army to Saint-Domingue, which was where there was most resistance to slavery. Toussaint Louverture at the time was leading the largest army in the Americas, larger than the U.S. Army at the time. So this is the battle where they were defeated, November 18, 1803. 11 days later, we understand that independence was proclaimed for Dauphin, and later on January 1st, the official ceremony, January 1st, 1804, created Haiti, this free country, free territory, where open arms, blacks from all over, from anywhere, and native peoples who were under the oppression of the whites were welcome to live as free people. So throughout the years, November 18th has always been celebrated in Haiti as a day to mark the prowess of this indigenous army which won us our freedom.
And in fact, it's difficult to overstate the impact that this victory over Napoleon's army had on the slave-owning white folks of the New World and of Europe.
Absolutely, because at the time that this happens, there is slavery everywhere in the Americas, practically. In the United States, in Jamaica, the nearest island occupied by the English, in Puerto Rico, everywhere else, Spain, you know, it was slavery. And the United States has had slavery at the time as well. So this was a tremendous feat. And we believe, and historians that are trying to honestly look at this, they concur that this is the event that leads to the eventual end of slavery itself in the Americas. So like I said, this has been a day that is celebrated throughout the history of Haiti to mark the strength, you know, the prowess of our indigenous army. In 1915, this indigenous army was disbanded when the United States occupies Haiti militarily. This is the first military occupation of our country. And the United States disarms the Haitian peasantry after having disarmed the army. And they created what is called the Gendarmerie d'Haïti. This is local Haitians, lackeys, I would say, who agreed to participate in crushing the revolt, the resistance of the Cacos who were fighting the occupation led by Charlemagne Peyrault and later on Benoît Batraville. And Gendarmerie becomes the Guard d'Haïti and later the armed forces of Haiti that Jean-Bertrand Aristide eventually disbands when he gets back to Haiti after the first coup in 1994. And what we always say, because people speak of this army that Aristide disbanded this army, we said that this had never been, this army of 1915, created by the United States, trained by the U.S., and funded up to in 1994 by the U.S., has never been a national army for Haiti, defending our territory, defending the sovereignty of Haiti. When Trujillo in 1937 massacred thousands of Haitians, this army just stood down, did not make a move. And so we have never recognized the army that Aristide disbanded in 1994 as a national army for Haiti, but as I said, lackeys of the United States in uniform. So yesterday was the ultimate joke, Glenn, when the puppet president installed by the United States, a lackey of Martelly, Sweet Mickey, Michel Martelly, who was also installed by the Clintons, by Obama, the U.S. government. So Jovenel Moïse was the head clown in charge right now. He supposedly brought back the Haitian army. And it is the joke of the country, 150 young men who, I think, a couple of women in there. But the joke is that there was a NPR story done on this reinstallation, recreation of the Haitian army that's online. And somewhere in the report, after they speak to the clown president, they film a training session of these 150 young men. And then the trainer is screaming at them, and they're not doing what they're supposed to do. And he says, you know, you people are screaming like a bunch of pregnant women. So it is basically Jovenel's pregnant women that are being passed on as a Haitian army. And what we say is a puppet government cannot create an army, a national army for Haiti, an army that would walk in the path, in the shadow of this army that defeated Napoleon's forces, defeated the English, defeated the Spanish army at the time. So this is the same jokes that are being played on the Haitian people. And of course, we know the people of Haiti today are the people of Haiti of yesterday. And we continue to organize, we continue to fight, and we will get back to the path of our ancestors. We are very confident about that.
Well, there's no joke and there's nothing funny about the large number of people who were killed in clashes at demonstrations where people were resisting the reinstatement of the Haitian army, demanding instead that monies be spent on education and other real needs of the people.
There have been, since September, early September, huge demonstrations in Haiti and protesting first against the budget proposal by the puppet government, where they would have huge taxes, new taxes basically placed on the Haitian people. The thing about this is that the people of Haiti are watching every year these new taxes by Martelly. Even on us living in the diaspora, you have this tax that's been imposed, supposedly $1.50 every time we make a money transfer to family and friends in Haiti. Every time we pick up a telephone to call Haiti, there is a 5 cent per minute tax placed on the diaspora. And for the peasants in the country, every time, you know, they sell a goat, every time they sell a cow, these new taxes that have been imposed by Martelly and now Jovenel, and people are not seeing what is happening with this money. What they see instead, the tax on the diaspora for $1.50 for the money transfer and the phone tax. Martelly had said this would be to build schools, to give free schooling to every child in the country. And of course, this is patently false. No new schools have been built under Martelly. No restructuring of the education system has happened. And what people find is that this has been a conduit for Martelly to siphon off money, to steal money. So people have taken to the streets, and eventually these movements that came as a protest against taxes, they've turned into huge protests to demand that the government resign, that the puppet president, that he resign. And although the United Nations is saying that, you know, they have shut down the minister, which was 13 years now since they've had an occupation force in Haiti, and they're saying minister is now mini-just, which is a justice, about 1,200 soldier force to support the justice system in Haiti. This is still UN occupation force giving training, giving tacit support to these puppet government on behalf of the United States, which understands that it costs them less money to have these UN occupiers as opposed to having actual U.S. soldiers underground doing the same kind of work. And as you said in the question, a lot of repression. Moïse Jean-Charles, who is a leader of the resistance movement, who was also a very strong candidate. Many people felt that he won the last election. And of course, fraudulent election were backed by the United States and the UN. They gave the victory to Jovenel Moïse, that handpicked to succeed Martelly, to continue the same process that Martelly had started. And Moïse Jean-Charles himself got injured in one of these past protests, and I think actually he's still in Cuba undergoing treatment. And in a popular neighborhood of Grand Ravine around Port-au-Prince, these massacre, basically, that this police force, they went inside schools shooting, teachers got hurt, students got hurt, and the government is saying that 3 bandits who were killed, but the people have shown on social media like dozens of bodies of people that were killed. At least 19 people were documented, but people are saying there were some other bodies that were removed by the police forces. And of course, the people fought back. At least 2 police IDMO agents were killed as well, and many others were hurt in this operation that happened last week at Grand Ravine.
Yes, there's been lots of attention to the possible reinstatement of the army, but right now it only has 150 recruits, and they're only talking about 3 or maybe 5,000 men sometime in the future. But massive casualties are being inflicted on the people by these 15,000 national police, which are a military operation.
They are definitely military, not being called military. What's important for your audience to understand is that this police force, this is created by the United States. This is trained by Canada and the United States. This is financed by them. The clothes they wear, if you look at the boots, their socks, This is reject equipment from the U.S. Army, their paychecks from the U.S., even the vetting of who gets in to the police slash this new army operation. This is all done by the United States. This is a means by which they are trying to determine the future of our country, because the leadership of these police slash military operations determined by the United States. So this is a colonization, neo-colonization process being put in place in front of our very eyes. And the people of Haiti understand that, and they are resisting it in manner that we are able to.
Yes, so the United Nations Armed Occupying Force, MINUSTAH, is departed, but that does not mean that Haiti has recovered its sovereignty.
Definitely no sovereignty. And like I tell you, MINUSTAH, they basically converted it unilaterally, UN Security Council. They decide that, you know, they did such a good job. Haiti is stable. Now they're tooting their own horn, basically. And they're saying now it's the new mission headed by an African brother, you know, is MINUSTAH. So for them now, the only support that Haiti needs is of the justice system to reinforce the rule of law. And what does the UN have to say about rule of law around the world and in Haiti itself since 2004, basically since 1994, that there have been different UN operations in Haiti, killing the Haitian people, absolute impunity, cholera, massacres in popular neighborhoods that, you know, no UN personnel has been punished for, rapes, theft of Haitian peasants' properties, and then they have the nerve to speak about justice, to speak about, if you look at the last report that they put out about these resolutions about the good work that they've done in the past 13 years stabilizing. Of course, they've stabilized nothing. This is just them with their weapons imposing on the people of Haiti. And of course, we cannot overemphasize that this is not United Nations per se, as if United Nations is some unbiased, some representative body of the world community. This is a tool of the United States, doing the bidding of the United States, going where the United States wants them to go, and killing whoever the United States needs them to kill. So the UN, we can say it has no credibility with our people, with oppressed people around the world. The same role they played in the killing of Lumumba is the same thing they're doing in Haiti right now. Nobody should think of it any other way.
The UN Secretary General has been passing around the hat, so to speak, collecting monies from various countries that would go to Haiti to correct some of the harm done by the United Nations in infecting the island with cholera. But President Trump doesn't even want to contribute to this little measly tin cup fund.
Yeah, this is the joke. We have no beef with Trump about this cholera business. This is a joke by the UN. First of all, you know, they spent years, like 5-6 years, denying that they brought cholera to Haiti, when every study, everything that has confirmed what the Haitian people in the Artibonite region themselves, they had said days after the first cholera case hit, the people in the area said, this is the UN soldiers at this camp who dumped their feces in our river. That is what caused sickness over here. You know, the UN did everything to cover up, and then it became clear the specific strain of cholera is from these Nepalese soldiers, you know, who had just been brought in from Nepal where there was this specific cholera epidemic going on. And, you know, the UN spent years denying it. So they're jokers, you know. And then you have another bunch of jokers here in the United States who are pretending to support the Haitian people, former workers for the UN. We're talking about the IJDH, Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, Brian Concannon, and clowns like this, you know, who are talking about taking the UN to a court in the United States and asking X amount of dollars for the lives of Haitian people. These are jokers. These are jokers. We ask them how much money do they want for their own mothers, for their sisters. We don't want no money for the lives of the Haitian people. We know the UN brought cholera, and Ban Ki-moon said he's going to create some $400 million fund to $200 million for infrastructure in Haiti and $200 million to compensate families. You know, if he spoke to us, we would tell him what to do with this money, to stuff it somewhere, you know, where, like they say, the sun don't shine. But these people that I'm calling clowns pretending to be thieves, to support the Haitian people, they're trying to get their cut of this. And so I think the UN now, you know, they're saying they can't raise this money. You know, there's some 40-something million dollar balance from UN money that was used to for Minister to kill the Haitian people. And now you have this fight by these people pretending to support Haiti and Haitians, saying, you know, since this money is left over from Minister didn't kill Haitians with this $40 million, give it to us for cholera relief. You know, this is an insult. Glenn, we think that the UN should have never been in Haiti. We think that the Haitian people, we have to determine what kind of cost our occupiers need to pay for the killing of Haitians with their guns and with cholera. For many of us, this is not about money. It cannot be about money.
Daoud André, speaking from Brooklyn, New York. In Washington, hundreds of demonstrators and journalists face long terms in prison for protests on the day in January when Donald Trump was sworn in as president. Chip Gibbons is a policy counsel for the group Defending Rights and Dissent. Gibbons says federal prosecutors seem intent on outlawing protest in the United States.
The first of the trial technically started on November the 15th. There's seven people who are on trial of the 194 who asked for a speedy trial. People were originally facing 8 felony charges. They were charged with felony rioting, which is not actually a crime under D.C. law. So the judge reduced 2 of the charges, felony engaging in a riot and felony conspiracy to riot, to misdemeanors. So the defendants are only facing 6 only, I mean, not really only, but only facing 6 felony charges, carrying 61 years in prison as opposed to 75. Another group of defendants had all of their charges unexpectedly reduced to 3 misdemeanors by prosecutors. But the people on trial right now and the rest of the defendants are still facing the 6 felony charges. People on trial include a journalist, Alexi Wood. He's one of 2 journalists who have been charged with felony counts for basically covering a protest. Another person on trial was a nurse who was acting as a medic. So it's really an unprecedented theory of criminal liability the government is trying to work under. They arrested 234 people at a protest because some of them allegedly broke windows. Police followed the march for 30-some minutes. They made no attempt to arrest the specific individuals who allegedly did the vandalism. They then surrounded on all sides and kettled everyone within the proximity, including not just protesters, but journalists, legal observers, the medic, and now they're seeking felony charges against them. And if you read the indictments, most of the people aren't named specifically in any acts in the indictments. And the prosecutor's theory, which is really frightening, is that the entire assembly is an unlawful assembly. It's a premeditated riot. Therefore, just by being there, you're engaging in the crime, even if you didn't actually commit any property destruction. And that's just the blanket criminalization of dissent. In the case of the two journalists who are being charged with felony charges for being there, doing their job as journalists and covering a protest, that's decriminalization of journalism. So this is one of the most shocking prosecutions we've seen in some time, and there's no shortage of shocking outrages and attacks on civil liberties in this country, so that is saying something.
So in effect, the defendants are being charged with a kind of conspiracy to riot, and there are not specific charges in many of these cases, because the theory in conspiracy is that everybody is guilty of everything that happened.
So with the original 8 felony charges, it included felony conspiracy to riot, felony engaging in a riot, felony inciting a riot, and 4 counts of property destruction. They actually charged 214 people with breaking the same windows, even though, I mean, it's really difficult, humanly impossible, one might say, for that many people to break the same window. And the prosecutor freely admits that that's not the case. And in gathering evidence for this trial, they're using somebody's statements on a podcast. They raided one of the organizers' homes, and the police seized as evidence copies of The Nation magazine and In These Times magazine. They seized an anarchist flag. They're trying to admit into evidence, a video from the YouTube channel of the Oath Keepers, the right-wing militia. They're trying to bring into evidence stuff that was taken by Project Veritas, the right-wing group that infiltrated the organizing. So it's a really shocking case all around. There's no shortage of things to be outraged about here.
Well, you use the term shocking, and your office has described what's been going on as the implementation of some kind of shock legal theory. What do you mean?
It's a shocking legal theory because it's not a normal thing for all of the participants in a protest to be accused of or charged with, first of all, felony charges. That's extremely rare. And to be charged with breaking windows when the prosecutor admits they didn't break windows, but the evidence they have against them is that they were chanting, "Whose streets? Our streets." It's shocking to argue that a normal First Amendment protected demonstration is in of itself a criminal act that carries all of these felony charges and makes you guilty for things such as breaking a Starbucks window.
And the effect is that people will reconsider even thinking about going to a demonstration in fear that somebody at some time might do something that the law folks thinks is actionable.
Absolutely. I mean, nobody wants to go to prison for 61 years. I mean, that is a horrendously draconian sentence. Even if you did break a Starbucks window, that's a completely disproportionate and inappropriately punitive response. So if you're thinking, well, I might just go to this march, but then if someone I don't know or a provocateur breaks a window, I'm going to be in prison for 61 to 75 years. And even if I'm not convicted, it takes months and months out of your life. You have to keep traveling back to where the trial's being held. Many of the defendants are from out of town. You have to get a lawyer. Getting a lawyer to defend you on 6 to 8 felony counts is not cheap. So it disrupts the lives completely. And it's exactly like you're saying, Glenn. I mean, people will be discouraged from going to a protest. And we see a trend right now with not just this prosecution, but a wave of laws being proposed that impose collective liability for the actions of individuals on entire groups of protesters. And the intent here is, just as you described, make people want to stay home, make them want to stay silent.
And I would think that people would also think twice about buying certain publications or accessing certain publications online, because mere possession of them might be used as evidence to back up some kind of conspiracy charge in the future behind some actions that have not even occurred.
Well, the online point is particularly salient because in the course of gathering evidence for this trial, the police have tried to get into people's Facebook accounts who aren't charged with a crime. They tried to get information from the Disrupt J20 Facebook page, including the 6,000 people who liked it. They dropped that demand. They were trying to get the 1.3 million IP addresses of people who visited the DisruptJ20.org website, that they dropped that demand. And I was sitting at one of the hearings for the Facebook thing, and the prosecutor said while they were dropping the demands for the likes of the group itself, they still wanted certain likes of Facebook posts because those likes could be probative of criminal intent. For example, if you liked a post about how to dress in black bloc and then were later in a black bloc, that could be evidence of a crime for the prosecution. And it's just mind-boggling what they're saying. I mean, it's going to have a chilling effect.
Well, in terms of using Facebook as evidence of conspiracies, the police have been doing that for some years in the black community, specifically against what they describe as gang activity.
That's a really good parallel. I mean, police response in communities of color, the black community, has been extraordinarily heavy-handed, and we're seeing a lot of those tactics now used against demonstrators. I mean, this is not new. This, in a lot of communities, has been under assault for some time now. That's a really excellent point.
So those people who are so focused on making friends in Facebook ought to understand that Facebook is not always your friend.
Well, the DOJ certainly isn't your friend.
Certainly the Department of Justice is trying to establish some kind of precedence for future legal action.
Yes, and it's not just Department of Justice. I mean, prosecutors across the country have been very open about the fact that they were watching very closely the disputes over the warrants to get the IP addresses, get into Facebook. I mean, in a lot of ways, these issues about when the government can and cannot get in your electronic communications are very new, since Facebook and Twitter and all of those things are somewhat new, and there's not clear-cut judicial guidance on what government can and cannot do. So these cases have the potential to set really bad precedents. And if you start trying people for basically going to a demonstration or basically doing journalism, that's also going to have a really terrible precedent.
That was Chip Gibbons of Defending Rights and Dissent in Washington. Also in the nation's capital, activist Netfa Freeman represented the Black Alliance for Peace at a recent national conference of the Black is Back Coalition at Howard University.
The Black Alliance for Peace is not a pacifist organization. It is an alliance of many organizations that understand the nature of resurrecting or strengthening the peace movement with the radical Black tradition. The radical Black tradition and its founding by its nature is internationalist, understands the struggle of all oppressed people around the world. We have to support them even if they're not African. We're down with the Palestinian struggle. We've been down with the Irish people who are struggling against British colonialism. It doesn't matter. We're for all oppressed people, particularly African people, because we are African people, but everybody. So we're internationalists. The Black radical tradition asserts that we are anti-capitalist. Imperialism, war, all these things are buttressed by the capitalist system. We understand that the only way to get peace is through justice. We have to fight for justice. We have to fight for, we have to support those who are struggling for justice by any means necessary, even if they're doing it through armed struggle. People think that's contradictory, but we understand that's like the liberal politic to set, and a conditional politic. In other words, you can only be struggling for peace if you're nonviolent. We understand there's no, sometimes just pressure gives us no other opportunity, no other option, but to defend ourselves. And we can only defend ourselves sometimes through taking up arms. And so we're not a pacifist organization. And a lot has been said about AFRICOM. One thing that has not been said about AFRICOM is that AFRICOM is also a mental assault on African people, particularly in the United States. It's a mental assault because it perpetuates the myth and the falsehood that Africa needs policing. AFRICOM has to be seen in the same light as the proliferation or the militarization of our communities, the occupation of our communities. Black Alliance for Peace is for the withdrawal of all troops from the African continent and all of our colonized communities around the world. That includes our communities within the United States. And we talk about troops in the United States, we talk about all the MPD forces, the SWAT forces, the DIA and all that, DEA and all that, to come and occupy our communities. We talk about troops that operate and work on at the behest of the imperialist capitalist system and white supremacy. And so we're for withdrawing that, and we need to understand that AFRICOM is the counterpart to the FBI's collaboration with local law enforcement against our people. This isn't new. This has been our repression and oppression that's gone on since we were stolen from the continent of Africa and brought to these shores. We should also recognize, I mean, a lot of us probably know about the counterintelligence program of the FBI that was came to assault the social justice liberation movements within the United States, particularly Black liberation forces. At the same time, the FBI was doing that the CIA was carrying out a counterpart assault on the continent of Africa, overthrowing governments, creating coup d'etats, and then after that, militarizing the continent of Africa with small arms and giving small arms to forces that were really not having an ideological clarity to advance a liberation struggle. Same thing happened here. Dumping arms into our communities with the, you know, with the cocaine, crack cocaine epidemic and all these kind of things. So we're killing ourselves in what one of them called assisted genocide. It's by design. It's not a reflection of our inferiority or anything like that. So we have to understand that. Two, the fact that America and Americanism cannot be extracted or distinct from white supremacy, we have to understand that African American is an oxymoron. It is a tying of two opposing ideas, Africa, African, and being American. If being American means the settler colonization of this country, the obliteration of even African states like Libya or anything, or keeping Haiti and where all our communities around the world under a thumb, then we obviously cannot be American. To be African and to assert our Africans is to assert an identity that is against white supremacy, capitalism, repression around the world. It's against what it means to be this Americanism. They even have the gall to talk about America to the neglect of Latin America. I mean, brothers and sisters of Latin America also get offended when they say America as if it's not a continent. And they say, man, they'll go there, like Americans, talking about U.S. settler colonists and a place in Latin America, and then don't even consider that America. And so it speaks to the white supremacist nature of it. One of the things also the Black Alliance for Peace is for, when we talk about U.S., we're for U.S. out of Africa altogether, not just the troops, because we have to understand how neocolonialism works, the machinations of neocolonialism, all the outward trappings and the dress that looks like independence, but it still means the dependence of the Africa countries and Africa as a continent is dependent or under the thumb of imperialist and Western forces. And so it operates in insidious ways. The U.S. Agency for International Development, Glenn talked about the CIA and these forces, and the book Economic Hitman talks about just the World Trade Organizations and the World Bank and all that kind of stuff impose and support and maintain neocolonialism in the continent of Africa. So we have to be against the troops, but we also have to be against neocolonialism in all its forms. And then the oxymoron nature of African-American we can see in this recent incident in Niger. In Niger, it was caught that the troops that are a part of AFRICOM, but here we see all of this fanfare, all this media stuff about the young brother, the David Johnson, who was killed. And in people's indignation about this and how it was treated, they inadvertently support Americanism. Yeah.
Right.
They inadvertently don't even ask the questions about what the hell are these troops doing in Africa? What is the role of David Lee Johnson and all these other people in Africa? And then talk and even have pride, usher pride in them being a five-star family and all this other stuff. And this brother actually is a victim of neocolonial thinking.
Yes.
And a victim of the poverty draft. So we have to, I'll say this last thing, the Black Alliance for Peace is for exposing and repealing the 1033 program that is designed to take as issue the arms from military and putting them into the police forces in our communities, which shows also the nature of this. But also, and last thing, in terms of this militarization, we talk about it, and it's an industrial complex. It is insidiously intertwined with capitalism. Not only are they dominating Africa through military, people make money. When the U.S. military budget, and now they talk, the U.S. military budget is designed, that money goes to contractors. I mentioned the mercenaries. These are people getting paid, right? They have no interest in creating peace anywhere. It's profit. Yeah, no one's looking for peace because it's no money in peace. And so we have to understand the insidious nature of that, and then we have to oppose the military budget, and then also realize that just to take a sliver, people fighting for the Affordable Care Act and all this other stuff, you just take a sliver of the U.S. military budget, not only can you provide health care and education, universal health care and education to people in this country, you can also give it to other countries around the world. So we're fighting for things that do the bait and switch, and we're fighting for things under the guise of Americanism and American values. We really need to be pushing a revolutionary Black radical tradition ethos and ideological projection and then implementing that into our struggle today. Thank you.
Netfa Freeman of the Black Alliance for Peace, speaking to the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has a new book out. Supporters from around the country held parties to help Mumia launch his book, titled Have Black Lives Ever Mattered?
Does the title of this work seem provocative? If so, then good. That's how it's intended to be. For if the question is provocative, then what of the answer? Is not the answer, no matter how damning, far more provocative? And yet, who dares answer in any way other than the negative? There is an old axiom, especially among journalists and journalism professors, that today's newspapers are the first draft of history. Like most axioms, they hold a kernel of truth, but there is more. Here is another axiom. History is written by the victors. The words that follow on these pages were not written by a victor, but by one who has seen and sensed what was happening on the other side of a prison wall, who seeks to convey those impressions with truth, and who has often done so several times a week. In a sense, the impressions recorded in these pages ahead are a form of history, Black history, recorded during a particular passage of time. During this particular period, we experienced the greatest economic disaster since the Great Depression of the 1930s. The cultural dominance of hip-hop, the nation's fever over mass incarceration, the Obama presidency, the spread of the Black Lives Matter movement, and the unexpected onset of the Donald J. Trump era. True history, what Howard Zinn called the people's history, is the one which gives us voices of ordinary people and create, through these words, their ordinary struggles. And yet for Blacks, much that never makes it to the newspapers, or if so, only in a distorted form, still leaves scars in the mind, evidence of trauma sustained from simply existing as a Black person in the United States of America. The pages ahead reflect the people's struggles in the invisible sectors of American society, sectors which, by a terrible necessity, are populated largely by Blacks, Latinos, immigrants, the incarcerated, and those with little income. The pages ahead are also, by equal necessity, reflections of insurgent, emergent, radical, and revolutionary aspiration, thinking, and living. For from oppression comes solidarity, resistance, rebellion, and change. National movements like Black Lives Matter are manifestations of such solidarity and resistance, and give voice to the eruption of outrage, angst, hopes, and insurgent protest provoked by each new killing. That such a movement was brought into being by three young women of color, Patrice Cullors, Opal Tometi, and Alicia Garza, is telling. For throughout American history, we have seen how the dedicated efforts of women of color have driven resistance networks and liberation movements. These determined sisters have both studied history and altered it, and continue to do so today. You've been listening to the opening words and introduction to the book, Have Black Lives Ever Mattered? This is its author, Mumia Abu-Jamal. I am here not just to read these words, but to thank you for coming to this party, to greet you, all of you, old, young, straight, gay, Black, Latino, brown, yellow, of every color, of every character, of every age, of every gender, for daring to join me here tonight, at least in spirit. I thank you, I welcome you, and believe it or not, I love you, each and every one of you, for being part of this day and this movement.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.